listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in, please do and contribute your thoughts and insights. Please call 323-203-0815. And I think that has a one as a prefix. So just to be sure we cover all our bases correctly, that's 1-323-203-0815. Call in, please, and tell me your view on the issue tonight. If not, please send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me at latalkradio.com and look for History and You. Also, please visit and support my Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube accounts on the website as follow-up to each and every program. Tonight's show is also brought to you by the folks at Avcom, where traveling safe always matters, and where safe travel is a top priority and very much guaranteed. Tonight's topic, the history and the culture of American music. That's right, American music, something that is supposed to soothe people's bad days when they have them, something that's supposed to make people even feel better when they're having a better than average day. Music always does something to people, something good, hopefully, more often than not. So, with the topic of History and You, let's begin by me offering a couple of early thoughts on the topic. Music, the God-given gift of simple notes turned music, made into lyrical poetry and woven in song. This is the gift that makes us dream. This is the dream that makes us live. Music is supposed to soothe the savage beast within us. What happened? Music today makes me nervous, makes me wonder about other people's state of mind, makes me think about how music influences, how it stirs, how it provokes behaviors in people in doing certain things, some of which are illegal, others erratic. But the most commonly heard is the loudness of bass music that twitches teenagers into an anger zone of dark feelings and projected attitudes, only to be expressed by stares of assault at red light intersections. Who the hell understands them? Whatever happened to melodies that would inspire a man to gaze at a woman in a way that gave him an appreciation of everything a woman can offer? A song only by a turn of a phrase can reach him or her deep inside and feel the surreal romance of a feeling for someone else. Whatever happened to those moments of longing when the closeness of a song touched only by a desire can bring you to hold someone and with the alluring incense of a sultry voice allow you to let the soul of a song speak the sounds of your heart with a kiss. Sometimes I feel like a dinosaur lost between time periods. It seems the magic of music and romance is long gone. Are they really? Well, you know, I sort of remember Rod Stewart, Barry Manilow, Bono, Sting have all turned the corner to romance the classics a little bit more. Didn't Bono and Sting both have some stints with Sinatra himself? Even Paul McCartney has done a thing or two rather subdued and romantic numbers lately. A young and eager Harry Connick Jr. made his musical debut based on the talents of earlier American composers. Across the board, I hear more and more artists looking back at the classical standards to do something with them. Today's music no longer says as much as yesterday's music did, I think, because it doesn't have heart. It doesn't have a soul to it. And it pretends to reach people, but it really doesn't, because it's so short-lived. Even late rock and roll and well into the 60s music had a sound to it that spoke to the quality of people's lives. It had the energy that inspired young people to break into doing things different, into breaking traditions and starting new ones, into redefining paradigms and coloring America into a more creative democracy. Hence, breaking on through to the other side by the Doors. Why have we've had a shift in the substance and talent of our musical heritage? Why? And how has this proud matrix of ours been reconfigured? Well, with me tonight are two gentlemen who can perhaps help answer these very difficult questions from a historical, cultural, and even anthropological perspective. But first, let me take a quick pause to remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 1-323-203-0815. That's 1-323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let me also mention a quick word about the value of Avcom. Airline companies, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at Avcom really do go out of their way to make sure that all their destinations are met. What do these folks do? Well, they make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulations. At Avcom, Avcom is a Part 145 FAA, EASA, and CAAC approved repair facility, and they've been in business for well over 25 years. Folks, I've seen the offices and the workplace of Avcom, and it is nothing less than phenomenal. It is a huge outfit that really go out of their way to working the quality of their craftsmanship to the best of their abilities. Operating in 17 automated test equipment systems, Avcom is widely considered one of the largest third-party ATE operators in the world. Avcom also provides repairs, overhauls, and modifications to nearly every high-end avionics system and associated components. Okay, so please call these folks as soon as you can. If you have an interest to do so, call them at 305-436-0300. That's 305-436-0300. Or you can check them up on the web at www.avcom.avcom-avionics.com. Okay. With me tonight is a gentleman who also happens to be a returning guest on my show when we were discussing the many aspects of presidential leadership taken after the movie Lincoln, directed by Steven Spielberg and starring Daniel Day-Lewis and Sally Fields. This gentleman, an educator by profession, will comment on the history and evolution of American music and how music has affected us throughout the decades. He also teaches a course entitled History of Rock and Roll. Mr. Pat Griffin, welcome back to the show, Pat. Very, very happy to have you here.
Great to be back, George.
Good. And my other guest tonight is also an anthropologist by profession. He will discuss the development of music from a cultural perspective and trying to address the issue of an ever-changing society as a cause of musical revolutions affecting standards and conventions. This gentleman also teaches anthropology and has been teaching anthropology for quite a long period of time now. He has conducted numerous studies on how events have impacted community life and national morality. Dr. Mario Cubas, welcome to the show, Mario. Very, very glad to have you here.
Thank you, George. Glad to be here.
Okay, gentlemen, let's start with a question. Aside from the obvious and the monumental task of trying to define music from a universal perspective, which is nearly impossible to do, let's chisel it down to only American music. And so, what is American music, gentlemen?
Well, from my perspective, one of the things that marks American music, of course, is geography. Did it come from here? But there's more to it than that. A lot of American music has some common roots. Both blues and jazz, and actually blues, jazz, and country, all have common roots in African traditions as well as in English, Scottish, Welsh, and Irish traditions. It's the blending of the European instrumentation with the African rhythm section and conventions that makes American music American and made it something that, for the first time in the jazz era and into rock and roll, became something that the Europeans were studying and imitating rather than the other way around.
Hmm. And from a cultural perspective, Dr. Cubas, or if I can call you Mario, how would you categorize American music then from this perspective?
Well, it's a very tricky way of classifying anything when you consider that American culture is inherently syncretistic. It is something that is created by numerous sources from around the world, including its music, and it's been a give and take. So when we consider music, I would say that to classify something as American music, we would have to look at the type of music that emerged here in the United States.
And of course, accounting for all of the other influences that have affected American music in so many different ways. Gentlemen, I have a lingering question because music affects us in so many different ways. What has music done to us? What has it done for us then?
Personally, I would say that music is us. I don't think it's from my perspective, it's not appropriate to separate the music as a separate entity from the society that creates it. Music is so intrinsically linked to who and what we are, and it's one of our communal ways of expressing ourselves.
So, I mean, what are you saying, that it's part of our personality?
Yes, it is us. Music is a way of expressing who and what we are at a particular time and place.
And of course, we draw music from our own personal experiences, I guess.
Absolutely, from our experiences, from our memories. Music is, of all of our artistic pursuits, it is one of the ones that is most closely linked to memory.
Well, this is sort of like what came first, the chicken or the egg, because, I mean, then if music is us, then what do we do to music? Which produces then in turn the other way around as far as what then we produce from music.
Right.
Well, I would say also that music is a form of expression, but it's also an expression of our identity. So in the sense that it is us, what we're saying there is that it's one of the multiple ways that we articulate our identities. And if we can say that we are Americans or even regional Americans, then the type of music that we listen to reflects our affiliation with different parts of our identity, whether it be generation or ethnicity or socioeconomic class. All of those things play into the kind of music that we listen to.
Yeah, that's true. And you know, I've always been struck by the idea that whenever you express something in melody, it's always received differently by people. You know, you can have people do a soliloquy, you can have people do some kind of an oral interpretation, you can have people reading poetry, but once you put melody to a message, something happens, something triggers, and I'm wondering what that might be.
I think it's, to me, it's that melody itself, just intentionally arranged notes, are not necessarily, they don't require lyrics. They're not linguistically linked. And in that sense, they're more readily accessible without language barrier. But at the same time, different cultures have different scales that they use, different musical conventions. What is atonal to one culture is not to another.
Right.
So there still is a language of melody.
Right.
But it does move beyond the language barriers and in a sense is more direct.
Right, right. You know, music many times is, well, not many times, always associated to events, the things that happen in society, major social events. And I'm wondering to what extent might there be a correlation, be it a positive or a negative correlation, between music and social events, specifically war. And when I think of war, oh my God, I mean, I can't help but to think about the era of the 1960s and how all of this just culminated into this huge musical revolution that where the apex was expressed in 1969 with Woodstock and so forth. So with all of this, and many times I've told many people that Woodstock was much, much more about getting out a political message, even anger about the war in Vietnam and strong disapproval of the American government for what its foreign policy has decided to be without necessarily counting on the component of public opinion, which does matter in so many ways and at so many different levels. But the correlation between music and war, what might it be? And I'd like to start by asking both of you if there is more of a positive correlation or a negative one.
Oh, could you define what you mean by positive and negative in a sense? Are you saying productive, or are you saying that one create something or take something away?
How well, for example, a positive correlation to music and war would be that, yes, music has a direct link in relation to the purpose of using war as a way to protest a war through music.
Well, I think protests have many times been expressed musically. We certainly have Neil Young wrote a whole album about it recently.
Right.
And of course, the Creedence Clearwater Revival is
yes,
closely linked to it, and many others. But there's also quite a few songs that are pro-war or, you know, encouraging recruitment.
Right, right. As opposed to a negative correlation, which you would have people that would say, well, no, music is music and war is war, and there's really no way of directly connecting any of the two. So I would think that many times, because we are music and music is us, mm-hmm, based on what you said earlier, Pat, then it would stand to reason then that there is much more of a positive correlation in that we use music to protest war as we did in 1969.
Sure.
It wasn't too long ago when I was listening to Jimi Hendrix express the national anthem when he played the electric guitar, and playing the national anthem the way he did upon reaching the bridge. Of course, he tries to replicate the sounds of war as he simultaneously attempted to maintain, and he did very successfully, obviously, the melody line of the national anthem. Clearly something well ahead of the time of an awful lot of people that were listening to it and reacted with moral outrage and saying that that's an insult to the national anthem, or rather national anthem. And we're looking back now, we see that this was an incredible vision and insight that Hendrix had in relation to music and war and its positive correlation that we're talking about now. Mario, do you have something some kind of an insight that you would like to offer in relation to music and war and how often we have found it to be present in American society?
Well, I was going to suggest that music is a very powerful way of conveying emotion. And often melody without lyrics conveys emotions that may be very difficult to articulate in lyrics.
Yeah.
And there is a long tradition of music used to inspire support for military campaigns,
right,
for war. So on the one hand, you can say that music has been used to protest war. On the other hand, you can say it's been used to support war, at various times throughout history and by various people. It doesn't do one thing. It does multiple things,
right,
because it is a form of communicating emotions and also of inspiring emotions.
Right, right.
Absolutely.
Right.
War drums, bugles.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And, you know, when discussing American music and the way it's grown so much, I can't help but to think about the impact that it's had on the world, which makes me to ask the following question. Has American music predominated the world? I mean, I know that obviously throughout the many nations, 200 some odd nation states that the world currently has today, and all of the culture and all of the music that they have to have, yet American music not only has a niche in the world, but has it ever come to the point where American music, one can say, has influenced and perhaps even go as far as to say predominated the attention of listeners around the world? Do people in various parts of the world listen more or gravitate more toward listening to American music, American rock and roll, and so forth, particularly within closed societies than open ones and democratic ones? What do you guys think?
Well, I would say that without actual hard data to support the statement, I would say that American culture in general has spread throughout the world through the spread of our economic system and the interconnectedness of the global economy. By its nature, means that much of the culture that goes along with that economic system has spread around the world, and perhaps even to places that would have at one point been considered to be remote. Now, what people do with that culture, including with that music, varies a great deal depending on the cultural framework of the people who are listening to the music. We interpret music in one way, but somebody in a remote part of the world with a completely different culture would interpret the music in a completely different way.
Right, right. At this point, I think we have a caller. Is there a caller on the line? No, it doesn't look like it. Okay. You were going to say?
I was going to say much the same thing, that a lot of American musical dominance can be linked in terms of time with our cultural and political dominance. And they go hand in hand. If you are the dominant culture, then all aspects of your culture get an amplified voice based on that fact.
Right. Right. And even with all of this, considering open societies and closed societies in relation to the different kind of political systems that they have, has there been more demand? Is really the key word that I wanted to use here in relation to American music. For example, during the Cold War, have communist countries gone out of their way to listen more to American pop culture or rock music than any other music within that society? Or within Arab countries, do they go out of their way, younger people, to break tradition and you know, go ahead and risk the idea of listening to American pop music?
Well, there is hard evidence about during the time of the Soviet Union that American rock and roll and British rock and roll were considered an underground way to rebel, for the teens to express themselves in a way that was not going to carry a death sentence but was still forbidden. The 1950s rock and roll and the Beatles, in particular, 50s and Beatles, were highly prized, sold in the black market in tremendous numbers. And we're seeing some elements of that as well with the youth culture in Iran currently, where the Beatles have tremendous amounts of sales, some of it permitted, some of it not, and listening to that music is a way of expressing, I am not what the government wants me to be.
You know, you live in a very tightly closed society. And in doing that, wanting to listen to rock or pop music that the American culture for young people have to offer must be some kind of a liberating feeling, okay? A breath of fresh air. In short, because of all of the conditions and tight controls that society imposes on people and so forth. Okay. What is the fear, then, that the authorities behind authoritarian and totalitarianistic societies have for young people listening to this rather liberating music?
I think, honestly, a lot of it is the same fears that some parents have about their teenagers listening to it. That it's the idea of freedom and expressing a different opinion and glamorizing thumbing your nose at authority. Asserting your own voice, which by definition cannot be the same as the authority's voice.
Okay, so then what is it about American music that can be depicted as thumbing at authority? Well, I mean, what is it? The strum of a guitar, the hard drumming role that a particular music has? What is the stinging part that one can say, you know what, it's this part of the song where I defy authority the most? What is it?
Well, I personally think it's the fact that it is different from the accepted norm. Jazz was seen as wild and dangerous and rebellious. Blues has some lyrics, if you dig down in the 1920s and 30s, that is as explicit as anything Two Live Crew did in the 80s and 90s. A lot of American culture, whatever is current for young people, is by definition to some degree oppositional to what their parents listened to, which is why they gravitated to it as theirs.
From a cultural perspective, Mario, what is it in authority fearing defiance from lyrics or melodies?
Well, from a cultural perspective, I would say that the big fear is changing a worldview. If there is a particular worldview that allows the power structures within a particular society to be maintained, then any opposition to that worldview inherently threatens that power structure. And I think that that's ultimately the fear.
Well, then what you are admitting to then is something very scary, because then very closed societies and their tight controls is a futile attempt, because once they are sufficiently exposed to more defiant and liberating music, it's going to chip away at that kind of hard authority.
Well, that may be true. It would chip away at it, but it's always also a process of negotiation.
I mean, isn't it happening in China?
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't it?
It happens everywhere, though. It happens in every case. When our culture and any culture is really not a static thing, it's something that's constantly changing.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that it changes is by individuals and groups challenging the norms, challenging the dominant forms, and then some of those subversive ways of challenging it are ultimately accepted, and some of them are not. It is a process of negotiation, and that's how culture emerges.
Okay, I think we have a caller now. Yes, you're on the air.
George.
Yes.
It's Dean. Good evening. How you doing?
Oh, hi, Dean. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Good. Thank you. Love your show. I have a question for Pat and Mario.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, when I think of American music, I think of rock, I think of jazz, I think of country, rhythm and blues, even hip-hop. I think of all those different genres, I guess, if you want to call them. Is there any other country that had such a rich variety of different genres? Or, you know, has there any other country contributed as much in terms of music?
Yeah, good question. Guys? They're thinking about it.
That's a difficult one to answer. Especially because, you know, when you say, has anybody else contributed as much to music? You know, I can only answer it from the perspective of a person from within this culture. As an American culture seems pretty keen to me. That doesn't mean that someone else would see it the same way. And we are a more diverse culture than many others, much more heterogeneous. And in that sense, we have more variety than some at the moment. But, of course, some cultures are much older than ours and have, over the course of millennia, contributed quite a bit, too.
And I would say, I would agree with Pat, with what Pat said, that it's our diversity that has led us to have such a wide variety of musical styles and contributions. And that would be a feature of any society that is as diverse, that has a history of immigration and the influences of many different cultures coming together and merging together in different ways, like ours.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I have a follow-up question, and this is actually from my wife, Joanne. She's been, I guess, monitoring very carefully the inductee at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And, Pat, Joanne wants to know, why is it that in the 25 or 30 years, I'm not sure exactly when the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was started, but she's wondering how come there have been such a few number of women that have been inducted in the Hall of Fame. She could recall, I think, Aretha Franklin, but she says people like Joan Baez, which is a favorite of hers, apparently is there. She's not in the Hall of Fame. So Joanne wants to know what is.
Well. Part of it is a reflection of how many women have recorded prominently long enough ago. They have a rule with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that your first album has to have come out at least 25 years ago in order to be eligible. And a lot of the feminism in rock and roll is coming due right about now. The 80s, which is a sweet spot for feminine expression in music, is coming to the point where they're starting to get in right about now. So if you give it another 10 years or so, it should level out. Although there are quite a few bands that are already in. The Supremes are already in. Janis Joplin is in. There are women, just not as many as there are men, because in the time periods that have been eligible for quite some time now, it was a male-dominated industry.
Yeah, Joanne mentioned to me that when Tina Turner was inducted, she wasn't the one that was inducted solely. It was in the form of Ice and Tina Turner.
Right, because that's what the first album was released as a duo.
Oh, okay.
That musical entity is in, and Tina as a solo artist, I believe, is also in. But they had to wait until she was 25 years from her first solo album.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Love your show.
Thank you for calling. Okay, let's take another quick pause here to remind our audience, in case you're joining us late, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 1-323-203-0815. That's 1-323-203-0815. Or just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. We'd love to hear from you. And let me also take a quick word about the value of Avcom. Airline execs, please listen up. This is a company that truly makes flying the safest and fastest way to travel. And the folks here at Avcom really do go out of their way to make sure that all your destinations are met. What do these people do? They make sure that all instruments on commercial airliners are in proper working order, as if that's not important enough. They also maintain all flight systems according to federal government codes and regulation standards. But why use Avcon? They offer superior customer service and the fastest turnaround time possible, with an industry-leading overall average of TAT of 9 days, calendar days that is, and a warranty return rate of less than 1%. A 24-hour AOG support, telephone at 1-305-436-6000. 0300. A one-stop avionics shop. They repair current production avionics manufactured by ACSS, BAE, Bendix King, Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, Smith, and Thales for aircraft manufacturing by Airbus, Boeing, Bombardier, Douglas, Embraer, and Gulfstream. They have licensing agreements with avionics equipment manufacturers, including Honeywell, Rockwell, Collins, ACSS, Smiths, and Thales. They specialize in repairs to all three manufacturer TCAS systems. AFCOM has a TCAS antenna repair program with a flat rate repair of $1,895, that $1,895, and a low $75 U.S. dollar evaluation fee designed so you can evaluate the cost benefits of repairing versus replacements. Okay, gentlemen, let's get back to a question that I had, which is somewhat of a loaded one. I'm wondering what circumstances in society have prompted changes in the substance of lyrics and the moodiness of melodies since the Harlem Renaissance and Billie Holiday's to the 1940s. What circumstances in societies have triggered changes in the substance of lyrics and the moodiness of melodies?
Well, George, I would caution to say changes occur all the time in music, as well as the culture that produces the music. And I think that one of the qualities of music, one of the characteristics of it is that it is often used as a form of subversion, cultural subversion. And it tends different musical genres and styles appeal to different sections of the society. For example, the house music today, a lot of electronic house music tends to appeal to middle class suburban Americans,
right?
Within a certain age group,
right?
It speaks to whatever happens to be on their minds culturally at this given time and at their age,
right? You know, I'm wondering about the event of the Great Depression. When people were suffering the way they were, with the scarcity that was running abound, what kind of music do you think they might have had in their minds and in their hearts? Probably, of course, short, peppy music to try and sarcastically point at the government and almost prick the government in trying to, you know, make them realize, hey, you know, prosperity around the corner? No, prosperity is not around the corner, like Hoover would say so many times, or almost sarcastically poking fun at the federal government. So how has that event influenced music, aside from a heartfelt, very dark and moody kind of melody?
Well, I think one of the things to look at, because it is an expression, music is an expression, it's not only a group cultural expression, it's also an individual expression. So you get a diversity of tones from different reactions to the same event. Mm-hmm. You do have things that are mocking in tone or in some way make light of authority. There are also some that are very strident. Some of the Woody Guthrie stuff from that era is very, very strident and angry.
Yeah.
And there are others that are just harkening back to a better time. Different people have different reactions, and the thing about music is there's a market for all of those.
Yeah, you know, and I'm wondering about something else. I'm wondering about the particular instrument that's emphasized or used more commonly or more often in relation to the event. For example, if you have an event that's traumatic, such as the Great Depression, because of the scarcity involved and the way people lived and suffered and considering the immense loss that people endured and so forth, is there one particular instrument that in the time period was used by way of an instrument more? Were drums used more in music? Was the piano used more in songs? Was a soft and sad clarinet used more often? Or how would you guys go about trying to figure out if there was a particular instrument that was emphasized that would probably echo more accurately the signs of the times?
I think that needs to be population specific. In certain communities, they would emphasize one instrument over another. For example, the diddley bow was heavily emphasized by Delta bluesmen during the Depression because it was the simplest instrument you could possibly have. It was just two contact points and a string over a resonator box.
Yeah.
It was something that could be made literally for, you know, pennies.
Yeah.
In your home, and even if they didn't need to use that instrument, they did as an expression of poverty.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the big band orchestras were playing what they had always played, but arranging it differently to express those.
Right. Emotions. Well, I mean, when you're talking about the big band, you what 1940s predominantly.
Right. That would be an expression of getting time out of the Depression.
Yeah.
Right.
Time was fun. Time was good in America. Time was stable. Time was secure.
Right.
Okay. A stark difference from perhaps a dark oboe that you might hear, or a solemn piano, or you know, maybe a lay down heavy drum roll or something illustrating anger or expressing anger for the times and so forth. But big band in the 1940s was happy, peppy, perky.
It used quite a number of instruments to emphasize excess. We're past this point.
Yeah.
And it was ensemble by nature.
Now, Mario, I have a question for you regarding along the same lines of this same question, but now shift gears to the 1950s up to 1970, which accounts for 1950s and the tumultuous 1960s. the rambunctious, I should say, or cantankerous would be even the perfect word for it. How does that change, culturally speaking? Because there's a huge cultural shift in the musical axis of that matrix from the 1950s to the 1960s.
Well, George, the 1950s were in many ways characterized by a return to certain traditions or a grasping of what many consider to be lost traditions.
Right.
And unfortunately, or depending on how you look at it, some of those trends tended to favor certain individuals, certain groups over others. And in the 60s, people resisted those ideas and rebelled against them. And I think that the music of the 60s reflects that resistance to a large extent. But we also have to remember that music is also a form of escapism. It is political. It may well be political, but sometimes it can be as simple as, I don't like what's going on. I would like to escape to something else, to something that's more ideal, idyllic, or perhaps to something that allows me to forget what's going on at all.
Right. What makes the 1960s a cultural revolution? What is the cultural aspect to it? What is the societal reconfigurative parceled or diced up and recollected and redefined and reassembled part of American society that was seen, that was experienced in the 1960s?
Well, the most obvious answer to that question would be the civil rights movement. That represented a huge cultural shift, paradigm shift in the way that we viewed race, the way that we viewed privilege, the way that we viewed civil rights and human rights, and the way that we viewed what it meant to be an American.
Yeah.
No longer was there one way of being an American. There was a greater emphasis on diversity, a greater emphasis on multiculturalism, and on the beauty of that diversity. What makes us different is what makes us special. And that was an ideology that changed with that period. And I think the music reflects that.
Let me shift gears, because this question, and of course your point is very well taken, but let me shift gears for a moment, because our time is soon running a little bit low. And this, Pat, has got to be a question that's right up your alley. Okay. Regarding probably your favorite band of all time, and Mario's, I'm sure, as well, and so many other people out there from all of the bands of the 1960s, now that we're there talking about that particular decade, what in the world was the magic behind the Beatles?
I think part of it is that it is a jump in sophistication. It's something that the Beatles wrote their songs on multiple levels. Even their earliest songs, something as simple as Please Please Me, yeah, or Love Me Do, songs that the lyrics on the surface are insipid and yeah, are written to sell records.
Yeah.
Those songs, even those, She Loves You, yeah, ends on a sixth note, which has something that hadn't been seen since the Glenn Miller Orchestra. And when they first played that arrangement for George Martin, their producer, he thought that they were making fun of him. you guys are calling me old here. What are you doing?
Yeah.
They said, no, that's just the right chord for that. Yeah. I don't care if it's never been done in pop music before. It fits this song.
Yeah.
They brought that kind of sophistication, that kind of knowledge, and the ability to write a song like I Saw Her Standing There, which is ostensibly just about seeing a girl that you like at the sock hop and, wow, I'd like to dance with her.
Yeah.
And then John Lennon inserted exactly one line to that song. She's just 17, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In England, the age of consent was 16.
Yeah.
So if you were old enough to understand that, you got a different meaning than if you were too young.
You know, I remember a song by the Beatles, and this is post the bubblegum stage of 1964, 65, 66. And even though during those times, songs that came out of the Beatles were, I think, you know, really classical from a melodic and lyrical perspective. But I do remember one particular song called Blackbird, which was political, and it addressed the issue of what Mario was mentioning just
Absolutely.
A moment ago, civil rights. And it just goes to show you how the Beatles were able to adapt themselves to the shifting and the changing of the times, and how they would come up with, you know, altogether different genres and different messages just to continue the hot medium of the message and to get it out there and to make people aware of certain situations. In this case, Blackbird with the civil rights movement.
And it's another example of the Beatles writing on multiple levels for multiple audiences.
Yeah.
If you're even a little bit informed about British culture, you know that a bird is slang for a girl.
Yeah.
So talking about a blackbird with a broken wing is very explicit if you understand. If you don't, it's just a song about a pretty bird.
You know, there's another question on my mind, because really, the Beatles were obviously phenomenal, and I would even categorize them, for whatever the conception of the word phenomena may hold, I think that the Beatles, in large part, were a social phenomena.
Absolutely.
I'm sure there are people out there that would disagree. Mario, would you agree with that or disagree, or what's your perspective on that?
Well, I certainly agree that they are a social phenomenon, and I think that it's also easier to see that now. At the time, they were quite audacious in what they did, and not everyone agreed that it was in a good way.
Right.
They did have the audacity to be experimental at a time when that experimentation in pop music wasn't necessarily the trend.
Right. And you know, I wonder about the 60s once again. Well, what circumstances in society of the 60s, from all the bands that they had, how did they manage to accommodate the movement and influence of sambas and bossa novas from artists like Jobim and Stan Getz and Astru Gilberto, to all of the sudden loud music and screaming rock stars like Led Zeppelin and perhaps The Who? And yet the decade seemed to accommodate for all of this collectively, all in the same box. You know, so I think that says a lot about how accommodating and how inclusive the 1960s were in so many ways.
And part of that's a function of income, that you're able to purchase multiple records, that you're able to have multiple records for individual members of your household that may not overlap.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I'm also wondering about jazz. Where does jazz fit in as a separate genre in the 1960s, socially, politically, and even musically? Because jazz and sambas and bossa novas had a separate and apart movement from the 60s, but it was part of the 60s, and there was a lot of popularity behind that. You know, and there are, you know, so many other things that I'd like to cover here, which time really does not allow. I wanted to discuss the phenomena of Elvis. You know, was Elvis a shock or a phenomenon? And also the art of the croon. Has crooning died out as an art form when looking and singing to someone in a way that makes someone croon and hopefully not cringe, let alone wince? But is that art form dead? And of course, the music of Woodstock, which is altogether unique. The duty of young people, gentlemen, is the duty of young people to shock.
To some extent, it is. It is the job of each generation to assert itself as a generation, and that is part of the process.
Mario, what do you say?
That is how culture is created. Culture is constantly changing. It's constantly negotiated, and it's up to the younger generation to redefine it and challenge it.
I agree. I think that the shock value is very needed just to keep that flow of energy flowing and reinventing itself in so many different ways. I am shocked. I am shocked with rap. What the hell is rap anyways? I don't know. But anyways, some final thoughts. I think we've come to the end of our time. Music as an art form is also an expression of self-sacrifice. Whenever musicians use their craft, they make themselves vulnerable to their audience. But by performing their craft in the way they do, there stands the hope that their music will capture and overshadow any doubts the audience may have about their ability to reach you and make you vulnerable instead. Music has always told beautiful stories of life and people in swirls of pageantry and humility, which have never failed to touch the failing heart that longs to belong, to be loved, and to matter. And no matter where you find your life, there you will find the music to lift your life. No matter if it's jazz, hard rock, samba, big band, or bubblegum songs, music becomes you. If only for a moment, lest we decide to forget our heartfelt songs. So tell me, what song do you sing? Join me again next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. by visiting our website at latalkradio.com and look for History in You. And also, please remember to visit and support my Facebook and Twitter links on the website as follow-ups to each and every program. As your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.
Listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.